Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have a new guest in Mr. Dave Foster, founder and CEO of the 1031 Investor. Before we dive in, would you mind please leaving this podcast a review? It only takes about 30 seconds. This helps us get more listeners and shows me that you're listening out there. So thank you for making my day with that review of the show. All right, let's dive in. Dave Foster is a qualified intermediary investment professional with a degree in accounting and a master's in management. He has over 20 years of experience working in all phases of real estate investing, from commercial to residential, and is inspired to help investors excel. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Andrew. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Would you mind starting out by telling us a little about your story and how in the world you came to being a qualified intermediary?
Yeah. One of my mentors once described it as, I wanted to go 2 miles deep in a 2 foot wide creek. I think in another interpretation of that is I'm a tax nerd, but that is what it is. Yeah, qualified intermediary, that part of my life describes the function of the unrelated third party who has to process 1031 exchanges for people. And for those that don't know what that is, or may have just heard about it, the 1031 exchange allows you to sell investment real estate. And then following the process using someone like us, a qualified intermediary, you purchase new investment real estate. And by doing so, you don't have to pay the tax or the depreciation recapture in between. Instead, all of that deferred tax is deferred indefinitely, and you get to use it for your benefit. So you're basically getting to kind of compound interest. You're making the money off the money you didn't pay in taxes, and then the money off the money off the money. So it's really quite a unique statute and an incredible opportunity for real estate investors. That's the qualified intermediary part of my life. The other part is I'm just an adrenaline junkie, frustrated real estate investor with more than a small touch of ADD. So I never met a piece of real estate I didn't like.
That's fantastic. Let's talk about this. You know, what are the latest legislative updates in regards to the 1031 exchange? I think it's important to touch on that.
Yeah. Oh man, so much noise. And you know, I've been now doing this for 25 years. And every president I have ever been under, every one of them, a Republican, Democrat, have all talked publicly about getting rid of the 1031 exchange. Because it's low-hanging fruit, right? And one thing that we've seen in this current administration is that they've taken it to a new level. Every year, they take it out in their next budget. But what happens is there's this amazing set of statistics that are true, that once they get rolled out every year, getting rid of 1031 goes away. And here's what happens is that they're shown by some studies, the latest one that's been around out there by Ernst & Young, shows that for every dollar that you would get by eliminating the 1031 exchange and in capital gains tax, which remember is a lower tax rate, you're going to stifle the real estate industry. Because why? If I've got to pay tax, why would I sell? So I'm going to slow down the velocity of my real estate investing. So there's going to be fewer sales. And every time there's fewer sales, the government loses out on the ordinary income tax of two realtors, two title companies, two appraisers, two inspectors, two real estate attorneys, two accountants doing an extra filing form, two painters, getting the properties ready. And when you start to add that up, well, first of all, that's an amazing amount of money that's coming out of normal people's salaries. That doesn't play well with a Congress who's concerned about getting votes. They don't want to be the one that put Mr. Painter out of business. But well, secondly,
like right now, I mean, the opposite effect is, hey, you just raise rates and then transactions come to a, 10-year, 20-year halt.
We've seen it, haven't we?
Yeah.
And they see that and feel that pain a lot. Mm. The other thing is that in real dollars, they actually lose several billion dollars in transaction velocity and tax from that for the sake of what they get. This is another crazy stat, Andrew, that nobody knows, because the current administration loves to throw it around that 1031 exchanges are for the rich guys. Mm. It's all these rich fat cats doing it, right? Yeah. When in fact, the average size of a 1031 exchange is less than $400,000.
Wow.
So, I mean, tell me, is that the fat cats, or has the current administration trying to take away a tool that normal America uses?
You know, I've been lucky enough. I think this is important to touch on this too, Dave. I've been lucky enough to travel a little bit, and into Europe. And I just remember being over there and seeing these properties that have like generationally owned properties. And they are just like dilapidated, because there's no real reset with a new owner to reinvest into these things. So I wonder, is there something similar to the 1031, overseas, or is this a U.S., specialty?
It's actually a U.S. phenomenon, because, your observations are absolutely right. This does not exist in Canada, does not exist in Europe. Here's why. This is a crazy history. Section 1031 was put into the tax code in 1920. Hmm. So, it's been there for a long, long time. Yeah. And the reason was that during that period, we were coming out of World War I. We desperately needed to grow our agribusiness industry. We were a hungry nation. Mm. And we were coming out of the homestead era, where every farmer had 160 acres. But how could they grow? The only way they could buy more farms was to sell their farm.
Yeah.
And if they did that and paid the tax, they wouldn't have any money to buy the new farm. So they couldn't grow. But even more importantly, what about all the young kids and future farmers of America wanting to become farmers? If I don't sell my small farm, I can't.
Right. Yeah. You got
how can they get in? Mm-hmm. So Section 1031 was put into place to allow those farmers to keep the tax to grow their farms. What a great way to stimulate that, right? And so over the years, that's been expanded and the attorneys got a hold of it and, all kinds of stuff. And now it's available for us. And we see what it does in the real estate industry, don't we?
Mm, yeah.
Now there's motivation. When it's time for me to change classes, buy bigger, go smaller, go from active to passive, I can do that without fear of this huge tax bill following me.
Let's touch on that. You mentioned going from active to passive and how one could use 1031 funds to, move to the passive realm. Would you mind describing that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, though, let me just give a ray of hope, because we just ended on a real downer note. 1031's going away. Every year when this happens, cooler heads prevail. And Section 1031 is left untouched. The last time around, we've got the Congress, Senate, fighting each other. The Senate voted unanimously that 1031 could not be touched. So I'm not too worried about it. Even in the current plans, they're looking at limiting it to $1 million per gain a year. I don't see that having a huge impact on middle America. So I think we're okay with that. Now, you're absolutely right. So let's talk about that passive thing, because one of the cool features about the 1031 exchange is that it will not only allow you to change into any class of real estate you want. So you can sell single family and buy multifamily, commercial to mobile home parks, anywhere in the country, selling in California, buying in Texas, selling in New York, buying in Florida. It's all considered the same as long as it's investment real estate. But it does have to be real estate. And many of the syndications or limited partnership passive opportunities that we see these days are structured so that there is an entity, whether it's an LLC or a limited partnership, that owns the subject real estate.
So you're investing in an LLC, right? In a business, not the real estate.
That's exactly right. And so it doesn't qualify for a 1031 exchange. Mm-hmm. So many people, I mean, I literally get these calls every week. How can I make this happen? Well, first of all, if it's the right time, and where you're at in your life cycle is telling you that active management's done, I no longer want toilets and tenants, then sell your property, pay the tax. If you want to put a small amount, because a lot of people will test the waters with syndications, if you want to put a small amount into it, do a 1031 exchange. Sell your property and pull a small amount out, because you can purchase less than you sell and you can take cash out in a 1031 exchange. You'll only pay tax on what you pull out. So then post-tax, you can go into your syndication, and that can work. Opportunity number three is that there are syndications out there, not very many, but there are some, where they have been set up so that you can actually 1031 exchange, and what they sell to you, instead of a percentage membership of the entity, they sell to you a tenant in common interest in the actual underlying real estate. And that can be a great way to get in and do it. Two problems with that. There's not very many that do it because it's complex and it takes a lot of paperwork on their end to make it work, which then secondly means generally they will require a very substantial investment in order to do that for you. Like they might say, well, yeah, if you've got $1 million to put into my project, we'll take you as a tenant in common. So, but those are all ways that can work.
We did that once.
Yeah.
With a family friend that wanted to put in, you know, $1 million, and we wouldn't do it again.
It was a nightmare, wasn't it?
For the paperwork that had to be involved. And you don't think about, you know, the tax consequences and all of that kind of stuff in addition to the paperwork. So there's some hurdles there, but I was wondering if, like, you know, could someone invest in a REIT, you know, with 1031 funds?
The exact same thing. The REIT is a business entity in itself. So when you buy the REIT, you're not buying real estate. Now there's ways to convert real estate into a REIT without paying taxes initially through what's called a 721 up REIT. Man, that will work. But here's the problem with that, Andrew, and this is going to lead us right into my last and best option. The problem with that is that once you go down that road, your compounding is done. When you sell the REIT, you're paying tax and you're paying all the tax and you can't 1031 back out of it. So for that reason in my life and in so many of my clients' lives, we always take great care to keep securities, which are investments in entities, and real estate investment, which is investment in bricks and mortar, separate. Because I can't 1031 across and come back. So if I do it once, I'm done. I'm going to pay the tax sooner or later. That's not cool. Because with the 1031, there is an option to defer it throughout your entire life. And when you die, your heirs will inherit that property tax-free.
That's huge. Yeah.
Plus, you get all the depreciation, all of the other components of the internal rate of return, amortization of the loan, appreciation of the property. You don't always get all of that with an entity. You're limited to what they're willing to provide you. So here's how we've bridged that gap. And it's really a slick way of doing it. The 1031 exchange, again, like we said, requires that you purchase at least as much as you sell. So let's say someone was selling a $500,000 property with $200,000 in a loan. So they have $300,000 of cash that goes into their exchange account. And they have to purchase $500,000 of real estate. With me so far?
Yep.
What if instead of buying a property for $500,000, they took advantage of the flexibility of the 1031 and they bought two properties? The first property they buy for $250,000 cash. Well, automatically, that just sets itself on the side. No muss, no fuss. It's recession-proof because it doesn't have debt. So you've lessened your risk. You've concentrated the equity, but you still have to purchase another $250,000 of real estate. So with the other $50,000 of cash, you go buy another $250,000 property using the $50,000 as a 20% down payment. Now on that property, you were able to reach your $500,000 target. You have a property that you're generating increased internal rate of returns because you've now got amortization of a loan. You got the tax write-off of the interest. The tenant is paying the mortgage. And we all know those are the things that boost the IRR to the moon. So that's a beautiful way to combine with loan-free real estate. And then my clients that want to go into passive will turn right around immediately and they will do a cash out refinance of the debt-free property. The equity is concentrated so they can actually get at a nice chunk of it. It didn't have a loan on it to begin with. So it's not like they're wasting the loan origination fees the first time around. And they'll take that $200,000 or whatever it is that they want, and they will go and they will invest that in a syndication because a cash out refinance is not a taxable event. And again, now you get the exact same components of the amortization of the loan, the interest rate write-off, the tenant paying the mortgage, the huge internal rate of return, but that money's also working for you twice. Because now it's invested in the syndication, generating the returns on that as well. I mean, that's as close as I could get to cooking with gasoline. And we're seeing clients do pretty well with it.
Yeah, that's an interesting strategy. They're definitely, you know, levering up and going for it. So thank you for sharing that with us. Let's talk about real quickly, if you don't mind, like what don't we know about the 1031? Like what's not talked about enough, you know, in regards to the 1031 that you think most investors should be aware of?
What's in there in 10,000 pages of case law? How much time do we have? The time frames are what scare people the most. That's really far and away the greatest fear factor in doing a 1031. Well, yeah, that is the first one. I don't want to do that because I only have 45 days to identify my replacement property and 180 days to close. Well, I'm kind of like Pollyanna, man. You show me a problem and I'll look at it as an opportunity. You know, show me a problem to fix. I'll find a way. The 45 days, is it tight? Sure. But what if you thought about your 1031 before you sell your property? Start planning ahead of time. We do internal audits all the time, and over 95% of our clients complete their 1031 exchanges. And this is going all the way through that really tough time when nobody could find properties to buy. 95% are still making it happen. So the fear is a lot more perceptual than real. But let's back that up. If you're scared of not having 45 days, you can go into contract for your new property before your old property closes. So why not, as soon as you get a contract for your new property, for your old property, get your new property under contract, be far enough along in the process that you feel comfortable doing that, using a contingency or even being far enough along in your sale that you feel comfortable with it happening. That's an instant way to stretch out that 45 days to make it something manageable. So that's a hack that a lot of people don't know. And then the 180-day period, usually that's not so much a problem, but there is a very strong trend in 1031 investing to do what I call capital expense avoidance. I've got a 1920 because it was all I could afford, right? So I bought a 1927 duplex that's block construction and everything's rusted and it's got a new roof that it's going to need. Well, one roof will wipe out 20 years of cash flow. So if I'm hanging on to that, I'm hanging on to a house of cards. Yeah. So why not go into contract with a builder who's got a lot, who's going to be building a house that isn't going to be done for 18 months? You go into contract, which again is fine. And then when he calls you up and says, hey, we're 2 months out from this property being done, put your old property up for sale. It closes, say, in 30 or 60 days, and then you immediately close on the purchase of your new property. You went from high capital expense risk to low capital expense risk. You had no risk of the 45-day period because you already had your property lined up. And most importantly, because you closed your sale and you closed your purchase close together, you have less time out of service. Yeah. So you're restarting your cash flow
quicker. Yeah.
That much more quickly.
Yeah, that's a
absolutely.
Good point. That's a good
so the 45
point.
Days is a big one. And I would say the other, you know what, your folks are all going to quit watching right after we talk about this, because this is the cherry on top. And that is that what 99% of people do not know is that you can eventually start to convert your 1031 properties with massive deferred taxes into a series of retirement primary residences. And when you do that, you will then start to transition deferred tax to tax-free for every year that you live in it. So here's a real example of that. I've got a client in St. Pete Beach who used a 1031 and bought three identical condos on the same floor in a building on St. Pete Beach. He used them for 2 years for investment, and then he moved into the first one. Once he had owned it for 5 years, then that meant that he'd used it for investment for two, had rented it for three, so he owned it for five. He sold it. He was able to take 60% of the gain tax-free and only recapture depreciation. Where do you think he moved, Andrew?
Into unit number two.
Absolutely. That's his retirement plan. No delivering Domino's pizzas, no bagging groceries. His retirement plan is, yeah, Dave, I pay a little bit of tax because I only get it prorated, but I'm also getting a huge chunk of tax-free dollars ever so often. And people who are doing that to relocate for retirement, like you're selling your portfolio in Cincinnati, you want to retire in Sarasota. It's when you sell your house in Cincinnati, the first, if you're married, the first $500,000, that's tax-free. Why reinvest that in a new house?
Let's circle back real quick. I love that strategy. Let's circle back. We talked before we started recording about FF&E and how mobile home parks have this really unique aspect where the mobile homes are personal property and, you know, the land itself with the improvements and so forth. Would you mind touching on that? I think that would be good for our listeners to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. In its original form until 2018, 1031 allowed you to sell real estate and invest in real estate and personal property and invest in similar personal property. So we exchanged jet planes, heavy equipment, restaurant equipment, mobile home park equipment for other mobile home park equipment. With 2018, that was eliminated. So FF&E stands for furnishings, fixtures, and equipment. It's all of the stuff at a mobile home park that's not real estate. And you can't exchange that. So when you're looking to buy a mobile home park, or when you're looking to sell one and do a 1031 exchange, you want to make sure you're working with your accounting professionals to try and minimize your FF&E number as much as you can, because you're going to have to pay tax on that, and get as much of it allocated into real estate as possible. because then you can go and purchase any type of real estate you want.
And the downside for the buyer is that, you know, their property taxes are probably going to go up because they have more allocated to real estate. So yeah, it's a fine line there.
That's exactly right. It's a dance.
Yeah, it's a dance.
It kind of ends up being who's lawyer's tougher.
Yeah, who knows about the 2018 rule change? That's important.
Now, the nice thing with mobile home parks is that when we're seeing the purchase, now, if you're in one of those where you own the units and those convey with the lots that they're on, the actual unit is considered to be real estate as well. So generally, there's very little non-real estate component. Yeah, you know, a couple golf carts.
Yeah, it would be the homes. It would be the mobile homes if it's like there's a lot of park-owned homes that you're buying and you're allocating a big value to those.
And those count as real estate.
Well, if the park owner owns the mobile home,
correct.
That would be
correct. You
know, where you're running into this.
Yeah, so those are the things to look at when you're doing mobile home parks. Absolutely.
Good to know. Let's talk about capital gains taxes. You know, I've seen, you know, Biden's plan where they can, you know, go up to 44% or something like that. You know, let's kind of scare people here with what the plans are moving forward for capital gains taxes and the tax rate.
Yeah. I mean, I think, my gosh, there's so much discussion going on there. Yeah. I simply look back over history to comfort myself. I don't think we'll see both an elimination of 1031 and a change in capital gains. I mean, that would be the whammy that would just, I mean, I'll be bagging groceries right next to you if that happens, of course. But over the last 60 or 70 years, has capital gains risen and got lower? Sure. But it's always stayed within a fairly tight range. And it always reverts. And although I've not done, my son's an economics major, not me, so I haven't really studied it, but I sense that there is a reason why that capital gains range over history has stayed fairly consistent. So with this administration, might they pop it up? They could. They could try, certainly. I don't think it's going to go massively huge. Mm. And even if it does, I think we'll still have 1031 to rely on. And so I'm really not all that concerned with it. But yeah, I'd rather it didn't, of course.
Of course. Yeah. Dave, thank you so much, you know, for all this information. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you, what would be the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, real simple. We created an educational website. It's got a YouTube channel with about 50 videos on all kinds of things, like what we talked about today. Nice. Calculators, articles, access to my book, and it's at the1031investor.com.
Awesome. And yeah, we should mention, you know, you have an Amazon best-selling book. What was the name of that, Dave?
It's called Lifetime Tax-Free Wealth. How's that for a sexy title? The Real Estate Investor's Guide to the 1031 Exchange. And whatever juice I got from that first phrase, I put everybody to sleep with the second phrase. But it really is about all things 1031 and more how to use them rather than just the dry nuts and bolts. We got some great case studies for clients who have been successful using it their way. That's always fun to watch.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Dave.
My pleasure.
That's it for today, folks. Reminder, please leave us a review if you got value out of this show. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Hey, are you getting value out of this show? If so, would you mind please going over to iTunes and leaving the show a quick 5-star review? I have a goal of hitting over 100 5-star reviews by the end of 2021, and it would mean the absolute world to me if you could help contribute to that. Thanks ahead of time for making my day with your 5-star review of the show.